In what decade is the culture or society first motivated to receive the theory? I've discussed and treated by now the question of in what decade is the society first able to receive the theory in terms of what books are available, but just making the books available is not enough to motivate the society to actually receive the theory, to pay attention to it, to integrate it. Society can possess books, but ignore them, just as society, our society now, possesses tons of research findings that show that cannabis is harmless, but the society is invested in a story that's contrary to that. So that those research results, those ample warehouses full of research results, are ignored. They're ignored even while the establishment status quo says, more research is needed. We haven't, no one's researched these things yet, and more research is needed. Well, those are just false statements, just plain false. They're lies. Lies, deception, dissimulation. Anyone who's in a position of prohibition leadership knows full well that the research has been done, the results have come in, and the results are conclusive that cannabis is not harmful. Those findings are being deliberately suppressed. It's not that people are ignorant of them, that the prohibitionist leaders are ignorant that such results have been found. They know full well such results have been found. They are actively, through self-serving, evil, corporate interests, whatever, based on prohibition for profit, deliberately suppressing the fact that they know full well that the findings are already in. But so the excuse continues as a stalling and delaying tactic. And we have to recognize these stalling and delaying and suppression tactics as what they are. If we pretend that the prohibitionist leaders are simply ignorant of these findings, we're just making the situation worse. We have to quit pretending that and say, look, you know full well the results are in already. You're stalling. We're calling you on that, on your attempt to strategically use a tactic, a self-serving tactic, strategically trying to stall and delay and make excuses and claim and suppress these results. That's a good example of how you can make the society able, in certain senses, able to receive or to understand something, and yet just because the society understands it doesn't make them embrace it. Again, a good source of other examples might be the No Historical Jesus research. Scholars might be perhaps aware of it, but they do whatever's necessary to spin it, suppress it, claim that it's been treated already thoroughly. Basically, various strategies all amount to waving aside and saying, yeah, you've led me to water, but I refuse to drink because I'm invested in the status quo. We need to look at the different ways in which society is able, so to speak, able. There's different senses in which a society is able or capable of adopting something. Like right now, in a sense, society is capable of receiving the ego death theory. It's fully able in some sense, but in other senses, the society is not yet able or capable. Now, I still have to do my full work of spelling out in simple Simon fashion to guarantee that any casual I'm going above, I've already done my duty, but here I'm talking about going above and beyond my duty required for claiming credit for announcing and publishing. I've already announced and published full well, but to make it even easier than that, I need to spell out in simple Simon fashion to make society, in this sense, extra able to comprehend what the theory is. Even if I do that, after I do that, make a book that's spelled out for anybody at a casual glance to figure out how things really went and in Christian history and how the role of entheogens, still I have to, that only addresses one, that kind of a publication spelling things out makes society capable in a certain sense of receiving the theory. But there's still other senses that still have to be addressed of that there's certain ways in which the society at that point still would not be capable or able to receive it. Thus, there are several senses in which a society, several factors for a society being able to receive the ego death theory, and several senses in which the society is motivated or needs to be motivated to receive the theory. So to talk about motivation, I mean, how much is the ability and the motivation interacting, interconnected? If you give a full ability to the society, does that help them be more motivated to adopt something? I think that's true to some extent. And if you give them the full motivation, if the society has a full motivation to adopt a theory such as the ego-death theory or modernity, the modern era, just because the society has the full motivation, does it also have the ability? So it may be that just in the same way as altered state experience and the theory are both important, you can't have one of them full developed without having the other fully developed as well, too. The limitations of the one act as a limitation on the other. So it may be that the limitations on the ability, on society's ability to receive the theory may act as a limiting factor on society's motivations to receive it as well. So the only way to have maximum ability is to also have maximum motivation and vice versa. What decade the culture or society was first motivated to receive the theory? Given that society has or possesses a motley pile of books, often ignored and dismissed, that serve as preliminary building blocks upon which the ego-death theory builds, what will make society actually motivated to take up the theory? People don't want to think they're actually driven by sensationalistic associations. That's a tangential point. We tend to think that, hey, all I need to do is lay out a logical, rational argument and people will adopt it, right? Well, by monitoring popular politics and other issues, I've really seen how it's just an illusion that people seem to be convinced and seem to trade in the coin of rational, logical arguments. Some people do, but generally the mind relies more on ergonomic shortcuts of mere mental associations rather than, which are kind of like propaganda. The mind works much more on the basis of casual associations rather than formal logic and rationality and critical analysis. Most people, what they do is they employ whatever casual associations they happen to have picked up or that happen to have been injected into their minds. They pick up those casual associations and they think, and then after the fact, they might rationalize those and after the fact come up with some superficially rational sounding logical arguments. But what's really driving their thinking, or rather their outlook, is their casual associations. The logic and rationality appearance is just being dragged behind that. And especially in the media, the more sensationalistic mental associations are what really drives things most of all. Rather than analytically, critically thinking about, for example, prohibition and its systemic effects, people instead will rehash and rehearse and work over in their minds these sensationalistic mental associations of, oh, this poor person on addicted to heroin, and oh, addiction, oh, that's terrible, and they'll go over and review and repeat these entrenched ruts of mental associations, instead of stepping back in a critical thinking kind of approach and saying, what is the problem really all about? Where did it come from? What's its history? What are the factors? How might things work otherwise? Things have locked into a stable state right now, but what other stable states are? People aren't doing that kind of, they're discouraged from conducting that kind of actual thinking. And instead, they're permitted to think only in very narrow ranges that take a huge amount of conditions just for granted. So when people think that they're doing critical thinking, most of the time they're being uncritical on the 99.9% of their thinking, and then they're exercising their critical thinking on only that 0.1% where they're permitted by the official culture to have variability. Like, what do you think should be done about the scourge of drugs, for example? Or what do you think about should be done to win the war in Iraq? So you see, as soon as the question is posed within that mindset, already 99.9% of of the material there is not considered in terms of critical thinking. It's taken for granted and assumed. It's assumed that it is, in fact, a war, and that it is something to be won or lost, when really it's not. It has nothing to do with a war or winning or losing. It's a corporate policy, permanent establishment strategy. It has nothing to do with winning a war at all, the Iraq. So that's just an example of how people apply, they think they're applying critical rationality, but really they're leaving so much in place that they're not really, because true critical rationality requires more systems thinking, and that's what people aren't doing. They're trying to do critical rationality without engaging in systems thinking. They're trying to do single puzzle piece critical thinking when they need to be approaching the entire puzzle as if with critical thinking and doubting every piece of the puzzle and questioning every piece of the puzzle and every arrangement of those pieces, every subsystem and subarrangement of the clusters of puzzle pieces. But people don't do that. They leave the entire puzzle there. They take up one single piece in isolation and then they say, I'm going to apply critical rational thinking to that one puzzle piece. I'm here thinking of this metaphor of puzzle as used by Earl Doherty, the Jesus puzzle author. He's an example of trying to take more up all the puzzle pieces, but even he falls into this mistake of just taking utterly for granted that Paul was a historical figure. He didn't think to even question that, and that affects the nature of the New Testament and what assumptions you make about or what assumptions you fall into unconsciously on what is the nature of the New Testament, how was it thought of by the original people back in that era, first few centuries. So Earl Doherty is an example of sort of like 50% critical thinking in the sense of, here's the full puzzle. He applies critical rational thinking to about half of the puzzle pieces there instead of the whole. I guess that's one thing distinctive about my own critical rationality, critical thinking approach, is that I apply critical thinking to the whole system. I do it systemically instead of more piecemeal. Another approach of where there appears on the surface to be critical rational thinking, but it's not being done truly in a systemic way, is you take the whole puzzle and then you pick up this one piece and apply critical rationality to it, and then you put it back, and then you pick up a different piece and you apply critical rationality, but you put it back, leaving the rest intact. And that way, yeah, you may go over the entire puzzle and say, you can in some sense say, well, I've applied critical rationality to the entire puzzle. Well, that's not really true. You've applied critical rationality to each isolated piece of the puzzle or maybe subset of the puzzle, but you haven't looked at entire other configurations all at once. So those are a couple ways in which people do a lot less systemic critical thinking than they realize. The mere presence of some critical rationality at a piecemeal level gives them the false impression that they're truly applying critical rationality. And you're not really applying critical rationality until you're applying it at higher levels, basically at all levels of organization of the puzzle. What are various scenarios for society becoming motivated, and in what senses might society need to become motivated before it receives the ego death theory? How was society motivated to receive the modern era and switch from the pre-modern era to the modern era? Each scenario, whether set in a past or future period, is a complex dynamic confluence of tipping point change factors. Perhaps the ability factors are more important than the motivation factors. Well, they provide different roles, I think. They're not exactly parallel. You can make a list of ability factors so that a society is able to receive a new theory, and you could make a list of motivation factors, ways in which society needs to be motivated to receive that theory. And they're going to be different kind of lists. The list of abilities and the list of motivations are going to be different kinds of lists. The different abilities involved perform a different role than the different motivations involved. So they're kind of orthogonal axes, not simply parallel or sibling axes. Regarding earlier versus later than the late 20th century decades, if the theory is bound to be formulated as soon as possible, there's no great need, perhaps, to discuss possible future scenarios, such as if I had died long ago, when would the ego death theory have been formulated, and by whom, and why? What were the motivations of that alternate person? Maybe it's most important of how soon is society able to formulate or able to receive the ego death theory, rather than what motivates it to receive it. But here, I do need to not be evasive. I do need to address the motivation factors specifically, even if the ability factors may perhaps be more important than the motivation factors for society to receive the theory. I have to stay focused on that, on addressing specifically the motivation factors. There are huge investments in the status quo. The established paradigm is hugely invested, and to accept the ego death theory amounts to casting off investments. There are reasons, there are motivations and reasons why people are enthusiastic in adopting new paradigms. Everyone wants a paradigm shift, right? Well, yes and no. Paradigm shifts cost individuals money or investments. A revolutionary paradigm shift is a loss for some people. It's a decrease in their stock, or a decrease in the stock of the paradigm itself, and then people switch to the more profitable stock or the more profitable paradigm. So, therefore, one approach to motivating society to receive a new revolutionary theory is to highlight and emphasize what profit opportunities there are in the new paradigm. Like, for a while, that happened with slow thinkers when the web first came out. There were two kinds of people, those who saw that as a no-brainer, that obviously the whole world was going to rapidly move on to the web, and there's no point in even asking why, or asking how it would profit their own current company. That would just be a waste of time, a pointless exercise. Things are going that direction. There's really no great point in asking why, or why that the particular company. I mean, more of a point would be to ask, well, how can we, given that obviously we're going to be pulled onto the web, how are we going to make the most profit off of that? Now, that would be a rational question, but just to ask the question as people did around 1995, should we go on the web? Well, that's the wrong question. You are going onto the web, or you're nothing. Basically, insofar as you stay in business at all, you will be pulled onto the web. So the only real question is not whether to move on, but how to move on in a profitable way. Similarly, the ego death theory could be posed as and presented as it's not a matter of choosing whether to accept and adopt the ego death theory. The ego death theory is truth. It's kind of like choosing whether cannabis would be good or not. Well, you don't have any choice when it comes down to a fact. The fact is that cannabis is good, and that's clear to people who are at all invested in prohibition or attempting reform, and to everybody. The issue, the decision to make is, given the unchangeable fact that cannabis is good and not bad, how can we spin it, or how are we going to relate our investments and efforts around that fact? How can we suppress that fact or highlight that fact? What are we going to do with that fact? But there's no opportunity to question the fact itself. Now, you can strategically pretend to question the fact, like with global warming and the President Cheney administration trying to spin and downplay that as part of the corporate protecting certain private corporate interests. So you can pretend to question a fact or to pretend to overthrow a fact, a raw fact. But that's just a surface strategy. So academia might, for example, realize, oh, of course, obviously ego death theories is true, but we're too invested in the old paradigms, so we have a choice to make. And it's not a choice of whether we believe in ego death theory to be true, but rather we have a choice to make about whether we admit and publicly acknowledge the ego death theory to be true. How can we do this in a way that preserves our investments, and how can we spin it and make our old wrong theories look as though they're still right? Maybe how can we downplay? And then other people would hop on the bandwagon to adopt the paradigm and work within the paradigm because they see opportunities. Maybe newer, younger people or independent scholars who don't have those investments in the old paradigm have more reason to work within the new paradigm. Thus the saying that people don't switch paradigms, they just die off. And then the younger generation grows up within the new paradigm, so no one's actually switched. The young people don't switch to the new paradigm because they simply grow up within it, like someone who's born today and starts surfing the web when they're an infant. They don't switch from paper-based ways of doing things to web-based. They begin in web-based ways of doing things. So they don't switch. And then people who are stuck with their typewriters and not letting go of those, they're not switching either. They're staying with the old paradigm. So nobody there is switching paradigms Rather, the old paradigm and adherents are dying off. So the old paradigm is literally dying off in the form of humans getting old and dying off. And the new paradigm is born in quite a literal sense, too, in that new people who are born automatically come up within the new paradigm. From that point of view, a strategy for me would be to not attempt to convert anyone to the ego death theory, but rather give up on people who are invested in the old paradigm and address only young people like high school and college students who immediately, directly, and naturally see the merit of the ego death paradigm. And they would then, in that case, grow up into it. I even feel that I can't convince any entheogen scholars. Either entheogen scholars ignore the ego death theory, or they pretty much readily adopt it and sort of grow up within it. So you don't really see conversions to the ego death paradigm from some different paradigm. You do see people who are not really invested or doing active research within any paradigm at all, you see them taking up the ego death theory, but they're not really converting from a commitment to some previous paradigm. They didn't have a commitment to a previous paradigm. The ego death theory is the first paradigm they've ever been committed to. So that's a useful strategy. Much of this focus on decades reflects American culture of progress. We routinely expect that anything newer must be better. Anything older must be rapidly becoming outmoded. From that strategic point of view, there's really no use in attempting to convince doubters. And I think you'll see that my main article, it's pretty evident that my main article loudly lacks any vibe, any effort at convincing people who are holding on to some other beliefs. I'm not taking that tactic at all. Instead, I'm simply laying out what the new paradigm is, and people will have two reactions to that. It's like preach the gospel to everyone and let God and Satan battle it out as far as who adopts it. So that strategy amounts to lay out the theory. Don't try to get anyone. Now enable people to adopt the theory. And when I say adopt, I don't necessarily mean convert from some other theory to this theory. They may not have adhered to any. They may not have adhered to any theory prior to this. In that sense, they may be really growing up within the ego death paradigm, or, which is to say, growing up within the paradigm presented by the cybernetic theory of ego transcendence and the maximal entheogen theory of religion. I am the end of the world for the previous modern era status quo world model. And again, that end of the world might not happen by individuals converting from the old world to the new. That end of the world might happen by the old adherents eventually dying off, and their world ends insofar as all those individuals who worked within that old paradigm are passing out of the scene. There'll be no one really who's any longer invested. In that point of view, if you ask how duration, now this is a question I need to add to my list of basic questions, like the four basic questions so far. Well, I need to add one that's the period or duration, like how quickly will society adopt? Like, for example, how long did it take for society to switch over from the late pre-modern era to the early modern era? It may take one generation. May take, you might say 20 years, or you might say one lifetime, say 60 to 80 years. So it might inherently, supposing the ego death theory is clearly right, and that anybody who encounters it with an open mind will immediately adopt it, and suppose I have a book that makes it just all instantly clear, as much as the article makes it clear. So there's nothing lacking in my presentation. Or in the theory itself. Suppose the theory is 100% convincing, just like, say, a cannabis research that clearly shows that it's harmless. And suppose you have the write-up of that report, and it's utterly convincing and utterly clear and so on. There's really no contesting it. And anyone who sees it is going to recognize the merit. So suppose you have that. Well, it still will take perhaps a lifetime, like 60 to 80 years, for that research to be respected and integrated and admitted by the society. That's the time in which old people invest in the old paradigm die off. So from that point of view, now I do think that the ego death theory approaches that degree of compellingness and convincingness. In that case, if the ego death theory is close to 100% compelling and clearly laid out and defined and written up, then the worst case then would be that society would take 60 to 80 years to adopt it, just because that's how long it takes for all of the old adherence to the old paradigm to literally die off, so that no one any longer has investments in that paradigm. We all have to take heart. We kind of throw a temper tantrum if people don't immediately adopt. Like, my God, it took the world 2 or 3 years to adopt the web paradigm. And I'm not talking about the 1995-96. I'm talking about 1989 to 1991, when people were ignoring the web technology in the beginning and saying it was a stupid idea. So we throw a temper tantrum if society doesn't instantly adopt something within like 1 year. We say, why is things so sluggish, like waiting for cassettes to die off, audio cassettes to die off. It seemed like it took forever. I was thinking, when, my God, when are cassettes finally going to bite the dust that they so deserve? And finally, it was called, you might say, by the iPod, which has a whole set of connotations when I say iPod. Cassettes finally died off. And it seemed like it was just never going to happen. It seemed like it took forever. But that we're used to things happening in America on a very short time span, so that if something doesn't happen overnight, we think, oh, this is taking eternity. Whole kingdoms are rising and falling while we wait for this changeover to the new paradigm to happen. But really, in retrospect, it did happen pretty over. Cassettes, you might say, did die overnight. First phase was mini-disc, which was essentially nothing but an improved cassette paradigm. I mean, it was an improvement within the sort of cassette usage paradigm. They were like, imagine if cassettes actually worked well and sounded great. That's what mini-disc was, but that didn't kill cassettes at all. It wasn't good enough. It was the same old paradigm and incompatible and so on. What finally killed off cassettes was the computer-centric approach with MP3 players like the Rio, and which finally broke through into prominence with the iPod. So how long did it take cassettes to die? Well, how do you measure that? You might measure from the introduction of the mini-disc to the widespread adoption of the iPod. Mini-disc to iPod, who knows, just off the top of my head, suppose and imagine that that was 10 years. Well, that 10 years for cassettes to die off, for the cassette paradigm to bite the dust, and for mass adoption and conversion, mass religious conversion from the cassette religion to MP3 or iPod religion, that took 10 years or whatever it took, and it felt like it took eternity. To me, it felt like it took eternity. I could not believe people were still buying cassette boomboxes and players. The ego death theory might feel like, why aren't people, the moment I uploaded my main article, why didn't the whole world instantly overnight switch to it? The world may switch to it and convert to the ego death theory overnight, but that overnight might amount to any length of time from 1 year to 10 years, to 100 years, given that it's a huge shift comparable to the introduction of the modern era. The modern era, how long did that take to kick in? 100 years or something? That's a fairly advanced, debatable historical question right there. How long did the switch over to the modern era take? It's a very complicated and very fuzzy question that could be answered and addressed in many ways. Even to ask the duration of how long will it take ego death theory to be adopted by society is also a comparably fuzzy question that could be debated and argued in many different directions. You'd have to define what it means to be adopted. Like, I listed some questions that are measurable, like, when is the first book scholarly book citing ego death theory. That way you could define how long will it take the ego death theory to be adopted, and when should you start the clock? I began my research in 1985, but I posted my phase one summary to, which was the Cybernetic Theory of Ego Transcendence summary article at Principia Cybernetica around 1996. But much better would be to pick, say, last September. Frankly, you know, I'm always wary of quoting too late of a date for when I basically made the theory available. But you can make, it's very reasonable to say that it was September 2006 that I really made the theory available, because that was the first version of my phase two summary of my main article, which included at that point the introduction section to really summarize the summary. You could say that all that material was available in my weblog postings and my website, but it wasn't digested really well in a boiled down summary well enough to my satisfaction. Therefore, the first time that I consider the theory to have been published to my satisfaction or made available to my satisfaction, I would say it would be September 2006. That, in a way, in a sense, that September 2006 version of the article was the first time that I was fully proud to sign my name to the theory. This is it. This is the theory. This is definitive. So that was the first definitive encapsulation or delivery of my theory, including the phase two material. Now, it's not even a year yet since September 2006, given it's July 2007. How long will it take, or might it take, or could it take? How quickly or how sluggish will society be to adopt it? A five-year switchover could be considered tremendously fast take-up. Five-year takeover, that switchover, that would put it in 2012. If we pick the arbitrary date, which I don't like, I discourage paranormalist thinking. It's irrational. And in a prophecy, all forms of prophecy are irrational and not in the spirit of under which the ego death theory was developed. But a popular date is December 2012. Considering if you say I first made the ego death theory available in September 2006, well, 5 years after that would be September of 2011, and then December 2012 would be 6 years after that date. So to use and take advantage of that popular date, that popular familiar date, 2012, that would be 6 years. So I could be giving society, I would say if society adopts the ego death theory by 2012, that would be an extremely rapid take up. And you might say, well, of course there will be an extremely rapid take up because of the information age is always accelerating. That idea has been really questioned in a great book I was reading. The book argued that things have not really been speeding up. We've just been looking at it from a point of view that is designed to filter out and emphasize and give ourselves the feeling and the illusion that things have been accelerating. But really, change is not actually happening any faster now than it ever has been. Change is happening slower now than we usually think of it. And change was happening faster in the past than we usually think of it. It's just pride, like societal evolutionism, to say that we are more advanced and fast in our take-up of new ideas than anyone before ever has been. That's just pride. That's the same as what's that expression for the British? Smug complacency that... all wonderful history, Whiggishness, I think, the Whiggish theory of history, that all history has been leading up to wonderful us, the British Empire, and that we are the most advanced, we're the ultimate destiny of of which society has evolved towards, and every other society can be mapped out on a spectrum of barbarians and savages and primitives because they don't match up to our wonderful us, our evolutionary achievement. So everyone compared to us is but brutes and apes. That's the Whig theory of history, I believe. And it's that same kind of thinking that makes us pride ourselves on thinking that things are accelerating. Because if things are accelerating, that means that, hey, we're faster at take up of new ideas than anyone else in history. That's just really pride speaking there. And arguments have been made to debunk that notion that things are changing and improving or whatever, that things are changing faster than ever. And now we have the snow ice caps melting faster than ever. So much for the drive to beat the record on change and that scary term climate change. So change now is scary as much as anything. As instead of rushing into progress, now we fear that we're rushing into our own death of killing the planet off. That's a topic that warrants more coverage than I've given it. I'm surprised that more people don't recognize this obvious theme that in the New Testament mystico-political story, Jesus' uncomprehending disciples misunderstood his meaning. They were all clueless. Everyone puzzles over, what's this idea of the disciples being so dense and clueless, not recognizing Jesus or misunderstanding him? No one seems I've never seen anybody have an idea on what that means. Now, clearly, obviously, it has to do, I'm the first one to solve that. And naturally, like so many of these riddles, like a proper good riddle solution, the meaning is very clear and certain. Once you figure it out, a solution, you know that solution's right. And that's how the riddles are designed. They're designed so that you sit there and you puzzle, and all of a sudden you go, oh, duh, of course, it's this. I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's how you design a good riddle, is by making it so that you either have two reactions, puzzlement and cluelessness, or the, aha, this is the solution that makes sense. Obviously, it's so simple. You want the solution to be simple. The right solution, by definition, is going to be one that's utterly simple, like that you're embarrassed that you didn't see it quicker. And that's how to read these stories about the clueless disciples. Notice that they're always clueless until he gives them food or breaks bread and hands it to them. Then their eyes are open. Then they understand. Well, obviously, that's entheogens. And the mystic enlightenment insights that come through it regarding Jesus as king or as a self-control agent. The entheogenic thing that Jesus gives them in the story opens their eyes to see the kingship or kingdom of God, and Jesus serves as the king for that kingdom, though he contrasts to earthly kings because he conquers peacefully, except in Revelation perhaps, but on the whole, the gist of the New Testament portrays him as the king who conquers peacefully or without battle. He conquers through defeat. That would be ego death, the defeat of the ego delusion. And I'm comparing that denseness to modern era academics. Those academics are making proclamations and writing books. Well, they admit their own cluelessness. And they say, you know, we still really don't understand the mysteries at all, but here's my thick 1,000-page book about it. And so their proclamations are really comparable to the proclamations of the disciples before Jesus handed them the entheogenic substance to eat. So here are people who know that these academics are people who know that their eyes haven't been opened. They know they're outsiders to the riddle, and they publish these thick tomes, all about what's known about the riddle, but they're not really offering a solution. They're offering like stab in the dark hypotheses, but not the kind of simple aha kind of boom, oh, it's absolutely this answer. You know, their books go in the opposite direction. They're more like, well, since I don't know the answer, the simple answer, I haven't figured it out, here's a thick 1,000-page bunch of verbiage instead that's kind of the character of modern era hyper scholasticism. It really, that's a good metaphor. Modern era hyper scholasticism. The very presence of that hyper scholasticism is just a syndrome and a symptom of them not understanding what they're talking about. Instead of them claiming to actually understand the mysteries, the establishment scholars in the current paradigm are saying, well, given that we don't understand the mysteries, here is a thick write-up of everything that we do know that clearly isn't the solution to the mysteries. David Ulansey tried to solve the one mystery of Mithraeums by saying, well, it's all really nothing but merely astrotheology, which I would say is just an initial building block towards the actual riddle. That whole astrotheology theme is just one component. But my summary of Mithraeums in the Ego Death main article are the actual dirt simple short riddle answer, which is, notice, much shorter than his book. In a couple of paragraphs, I provide the simple riddle solution to the meaning of the Mithraeums, supported by a 27-page document surrounding those couple of paragraphs, whereas Ulansey writes a whole book to argue that Mithraeums are astrotheology. I found, finally, the zine with my first published article, The Bubble of Simulation. It wasn't in Crash Collusion, it was in Fringeware Review in 1994. So you see the editors mentioning my book project back in 1994. I was glad to turn up that date. I was glad to turn up that date specifically that shows that it's in print, published back in 94, saying that I'm writing a book on the ego-death theory. There's some caution. People have cautioned each other about dogmatically adopting the ego-death theory, which is kind of strange because the ego-death theory has always been offered in the exact opposite spirit of dogmatic belief. It's always been offered, to the core. I mean, it was not only presented, but actually developed through critical thinking. So it's rather pointless to say that you don't want to adopt the ego-death theory in a dogmatic fashion. Everything about the ego-death theory is the exact opposite of dogmatic acceptance. I have already written a whole webpage about that, which I should add this posting in the subject line, ego-death theory propagates by modern testing, not dogmatic authority. Should add that to the webpage article. And my approach, while I'm always talking about the postmodern revolution, ego-death as a postmodern thing, you reach postmodernity by properly and fully working through mastering everything, all the wonderful things that the modern era has to offer. So in a major sense, the ego-death theory is thoroughly a modern era product, but it's a modern era product that leads beyond the modern era. So it transcends modernity in that sense of building on and modifying, just sort of like Einstein's physics transcends Newton's. It essentially preserves Newton's while making certain modifications. Well, same with the postmodern era. The postmodern era really builds on the modern era and sort of follows the innate logic of the modern era to its full fruition until it blossoms and becomes then something else that's a product of the modern era. So the postmodernity is the product of the modern era, is the ultimate product of the modern era. And so you could really say that the ego-death revolution or the ego-death theory is the ultimate product of the late modern era. Now I switch the subject line a little bit from why ego death was systematized in 2006 to how the ego death revolution will play out. That's where I introduce the concept of the ego death revolution. There's a few postings on that, and then I really start what I've long needed to do, introducing some cybernetics concepts explicitly, list of cybernetics or systems theory concept that need to be developed yet more explicitly. Okay, so that's the current subject lines to catch up with my commentary on various postings. How the ego death revolution will play out. By what means will the ego death theory be received by society, including academic fields and popular culture? Popular culture is important to consider because academia is always at risk of being passed by popular culture, by being leapfrogged by popular culture. Just as academic technology departments are at risk of being leapfrogged by industry, so that they eventually work together hand in hand. And one is never going to get too awful far ahead of the other. Well, you might say that popular culture of popular use of psychoactives has accelerated. That's not quite the right way to put it, but has split from academic official culture. In academic official culture, well, it doesn't really dare go into psychoactives much at all. Academia is pretty much mute, relatively mute on the whole subject of psychoactives. It's a taboo subject almost entirely. So it's a subject that occurs somewhat in popular culture and independent scholarship, but it barely occurs at all in academia. Wasson managed to pull a few people, a few academics into his project. But Wasson kind of, I feel like it proves my point that Wasson would be popular culture. Now, he was elitist non-academic culture, and he brought in academics like Schultes. And he brought in Albert Hofmann, who would represent industry rather than academia. So here you have Wasson, who's the elite. Wasson has been received. He was very influential in popular culture, and he hated that, strangely. He was popular despite himself, whereas Leary was popular, meant to be popular. So here you have Leary representing popular culture. Here you have Wasson representing elite, elite yet popular. And you have Albert Hofmann representing industry, and you have Schultes and the other academics that Wasson pulled in representing academia. So you have various different camps who participated in the Leary-Wasson era. Now, I wouldn't... So a question kind of arises there of, was there a kind of revolution, you know, the psychedelics revolution or something like that, through industry and popular culture and academia? There was. I mean, that was part of the late 60s with... I mean, you had Wasson and Albert Hofmann and a lot of others investigating these areas, but the research was kind of cut off. And then Clark Heinrich, as an independent scholar, did his work. So you do have different parties involved in different roles, kind of vying with each other and cooperating with each other. In this posting, I brought in that idea that the ego death era is the postmodern era. I've mentioned that a lot. I've discussed it at some length before, but I'm kind of making more hyperbolic emphasis of that point here. And I realized in this posting that to consider the kind of changes involved in switch over to the ego death paradigm is really not comparable to what they usually call revolutions within a particular field. It's more comparable to an entire epoch or era, such as the switch over into the modern era. So that posting is the first time I stated that particular idea regarding the scope and the difficulty of finding examples of revolutions that were such at a such high level and so sweeping as the changes that will be needed in various academic fields to integrate the ego death paradigm or to switch over from the existing paradigm to make a discontinuous shift largely, mostly discontinuous shift into future research that happens within the ego death paradigm, or while at least keeping the paradigm in mind. That'll be the first initial step is, first of all, do your existing research, but now with the ego death theory in mind, and then more of a full-on adoption and conversion to the ego death paradigm. Now, although this may be the first time I made that particular point in this posting, I have been studying with some fascination, less than I'd like to recently, how did the modern era come about? It's a great question. I guess in that sense, I'm through actually studying the ancient period, antiquity. I figured them out. I figured out antiquity, that culture and their paradigm, their metaphor systems that they used. But now I'm pretty interested, I guess, and it has to do with Western esotericism. The early modern era was very much informed by Western esotericism. Even in a sense, the early modern era could be even considered somewhat of a product of Western esotericism. The main triumvirate of Western esotericism is magic, alchemy, and astrological ascent mysticism. But then once modernity proper was entered into, and once it had really gotten up its momentum and gotten on its feet, rapidly Western esotericism was suppressed or left out of the official modern culture. And it was very much present. Western esotericism remained very much present in culture, in sort of popular culture, but not in official culture. Official modern rational culture became that was one of the splits. Now, Ken Wilber's early books talk about have language talking about these kind of dissociations and splits, that the modern era dissociated itself from its own ongoing esotericism, like theosophy, for example, and magnetism. just as in today's culture, psychoactive's use is extremely popular. And is rampant, happens all over. It's the norm. That's a better way to put it, really. It's the norm. Popular is a gross understatement. Psychoactive use is the norm in college, which is the initiation period that people go through, high school to some extent, but especially college. Psychoactive use is the norm. It would be abnormal not to use the psychoactives. And yet the official culture has a kind of a, however Wilber would describe it, not psychotic, but another term, modern culture has a dissociation and a suppression from its own built-in psychoactives use that is the norm for college. So that's a sort of schizophrenic split in a rift within the modern era, a self-contradiction within modernity. Thus, you have these presidents who've used psychoactives but have to spin and downplay and suppress that and treat their own behavior as abnormal when everyone knows. So everyone treats this behavior as abnormal at the same time as everyone knows that this behavior is normal. So it's just insanity, which is related to how Wilber discusses these splits or rifts as we go through different stages of psycho-spiritual development. The psychoactive use becomes dissociated during... It's present, it's very much present, but it's the repressed shadow or whatever, the unowned, the disowned and repressed shadow of modernity is the heavy, normal use of psychoactives that's treated by the official conscious culture. It's treated, that normal usage is treated as if it were abnormal and a horrible thing. It's a direct self-contradiction. Trying to take two opposite positions at once on the same topic. What mechanisms of motivation will be involved in the late modern era adopting the ego death paradigm in order to form true postmodernity? I think that the postmodern era has started, depending on how you set your calendar. You could say 1950 it started, you could say 2000, or you could say 1980, just like asking when did the modern era begin, it's a fuzzy question. And you can ask, well, when did modernity proper begin? Well, it began when society suppressed esotericism, so that esotericism and religious experiencing was disowned by the official society, and all kinds of crazy self-contradictions came in. Now, so you can ask, when did modernity proper begin? In similar way, you can ask, when will the postmodern era proper begin? Rather than what we have now, we're sort of right now in the proto-postmodern era, the early beginnings of the postmodern era, but it hasn't really gotten started yet, and it will. Around 2012, when the ego death theory is starting to have an effect, I've seen my work in other fields has taken time, and I always have a tantrum when my ideas aren't adopted immediately by industry, but then they are adopted after 10 years, just like the web took 5 years, 5 to 10 years, really, to be adopted. I've seen the same things. I mean, these fields are sluggish. They're conservative. They're slow to change. People in them are deeply entrenched in their ruts of thinking. I've had to argue the most obvious elementary points with people who design some products to they don't get it themselves. But then 10 years later, everyone comes out with the kind of changes that I was, beating my fist on the table earlier to try to get people to acknowledge or comprehend that these are great ideas. And then 10 years later, I finally see the industry taking them up. A 10-year take-up adoption rate would be pretty much par for the course, I guess is the way to put it. If ego death theory takes 5 to 10 years to be adopted, is that fast? Is that slow? Is it sluggish? Is it a perceptive and quick reaction? Well, it's pretty much par for the course. Real changes, despite all this hype about and hyperbole about how we change and improve and at a faster rate than anyone before. Well, no, it's always been about a 5 to 10 year scale that any real interesting, like subscribing to a magazine, you might as well only subscribe once every 5 years, because that's the scale at which change has really always happened in America and during the modern era. We don't see magazines switching from a 4-week now to a 3-week publishing schedule because everything's speeding up, and now a 2-week publishing schedule. Things aren't really changing any faster than that. So a 5 to 10 year take up could be either considered excellent or disappointing or just par for the course. And it would be quite reasonable to target typical take up time for the ego death paradigm and to therefore targeted as, starting with September 2006, targeted as late as September of 2016, that would be a 10-year take-up. Or September of 2011, that would be a 5-year take-up. So 5 to 10-year take-up, might mean like a 7.5-year take-up would be 2006 plus 7.5 years, like, or 2014 early. So let's just say 2015, if ego death is taken up by 2015, that would be neither fast nor slow. That'd be par for the course. That's useful, because now we can say, well, what would need to be done? What would need to occur as far as motivations and abilities and enablements? What would need to occur to enable the ego death paradigm or theory to be taken up in a standard timely manner, such as by 2015, a little less than 10 years after my publishing the main article with the introduction. And that's a really useful perspective there. Instead of just saying, how can I make it happen as fast as possible? Well, why not say how to make this happen at a standard pace? What will be involved? So given the assumption that should be made, One should make the assumption that the ego death theory will be adopted and will be adopted in pretty much a standard, ordinary rate of speed. Say, 5 to 10 years or a little less than 10 years. Given that it's inevitable, let's just suppose that it's smart, makes sense to suppose it's inevitable for various reasons, because it's the elegant solution to many fields, to the puzzles in many fields. So the solution is now available to the puzzles in many fields. How quickly it will be taken up? It'll be taken up in the usual time that it takes these things to be taken up, say a little less than 10 years. Now we can go on, so instead of us hurrying to deviate from that time frame, which would just be beating the head against the wall, it's much more profitable to say, okay, given that time frame of a little less than 10 years, what things need to occur as part of that take-up? Things need to be published, citations need to be made, various activities. We can expect a slow yet fast yet normal reaction rate. Even, again, the web feels like it happened overnight, but it sure didn't feel that way to Tim Berners-Lee in those early few years when he went around to deaf ears. He introduced it in 1989, and the web didn't really get going until 1999, suppose we say. Say, 7.5 years later. So even something that's as much of an example of an overnight rapid take-up as the web took that same time frame, 5 to 10 years, starting from 1989. 5 years after 89 was 94. Most people had not heard of the web in 94. Only the real early adopters who were really living online already before the web, those people were the first really to recognize. So the web took 5 to 10 years. Now, am I trying to expect and demand that the ego death paradigm be taken up at a rate faster than the web was taken up? That's unreasonable. Modernity didn't happen the modern era switchover didn't happen in 5 years. Although Newton's Principia can be looked at on that time frame of 5 to 10 years. You have to look at a 5 to 10 year period to examine the history of the reception of the Principia and how it had its effects that spread throughout other fields, how he influenced other fields in the humanities, thus getting the ball rolling on the whole modern era and especially the idea of the modern era. The Newton didn't happen overnight, nor did he take forever. It was 5 to 10 years. These things take 5 to 10 years. What exactly and specifically is involved on the 5 to 10 year scale in the postmodern ego-death revolution that amounts to a massive-scale, transdisciplinary, revolutionary paradigm shift or deep uber-paradigm shift across many fields? So I'm here improving the question. I'm taking initial stabs at answering the question, but before that's possible, I'm having to improve the question and adding the question of duration, which I think the answer is 5 to 10 years. Now, I have asked specific questions like, when will the first book, for scholarly books, cite the ego-death theory as a whole and not just mention that the ego-death website and not just mention that the ego-death website has some interesting articles about entheogens, or that mentions only that the entheogen website has some interesting articles about no historical Paul or something like that. I'm defining the objective as being the theory as a whole being acknowledged as an integral whole. That was an important point that came in this posting or this thread. One of the key things that the theory is shackled to is entheogenesis. If one way or another, if people continue using entheogens a lot, or if it ramps up or something, I'd say that to the extent that people use entheogens, to that extent, the entheogen theory is liable to be recognized more. Like, in other words, if everybody were huge, if huge masses were to start using entheogens, then there'd be a huge interest in the ego death article and theory. In that sense, the take up of the ego death theory is pretty directly linked to the take-up rate of entheogen use and the take-up rate of the web as a general context in which academic research happens. Now, the Google search results really throw a wrench into trying to predict new revolutions, because people have to discover the theory now. I mean, discover my work on the theory, discover my web pages specifically. They are able to do that. Anyone who happens to run any of hundreds of different queries will prominently see this huge resource stick out or jump out as being relevant, highly relevant, much more relevant, unusually relevant. And so that could really drastically accelerate take-up rate or discovery rate of the write-up of the theory, making prediction tricky and difficult or complex. The ego death revolution will occur through the web. Somehow the web will certainly be very much involved, and entheogen use will be very much involved, or entheogen studies, maybe I should say. The ego death revolution will include ending prohibition. So drug policy reform, which phrase I'm growing to hate the phrase drug policy reform. It's more a matter of ending prohibition. Just knock the whole damn thing off. Just quit it. Stop. Stop the prohibition for profit strategy entirely. Cut it out the roots. Make it no longer possible to profit from prohibition. So the repeal of prohibition is pretty directly connected. These are factors that, if they switched a lot, or if certain things occur in these different areas, it would bode very well for the rapid take-up of the ego-death theory. And also, I really like that point that I brought in, which was the new point, that the take-up of certain of these fields or alternate histories, the take-up of those is actually being restricted by the lack of having my theory. So my theory is waiting for certain things to happen in these fields before it can be taken up, and vice versa. Conversely, these fields are waiting for the entheogen theory before these fields can have much significant rapid take-up. So it goes both ways. Another example is that guy who was caught in sexual affairs with a man. That was the kind of thing that I really paid close attention to, because things that go on in church scandals within evangelical pop American Christianity are pretty directly linked to the take-up rate of the entheogen theory. Clearly, I call that pop Christianity genital-centric Christianity, because due to the dynamics and filtering effects of controversies, sort of the safest or the most prominent controversies used to define different groups of pop Christians are abortion and homosexuality. I don't really recall the right way to put it offhand, but those topics, the sex related and family raising and protect the children, and the protect the children approach, that mentality, those are all are, for various reasons, the all predominant topics within the Christian groups that they debate among themselves and with the so-called non-religious secular world. They justify everything, whole lifestyles, in terms of protect the children and stop abortion and prevent homosexuality. So that's why I call that pop Christianity. What's so definitive of it is, it's due to filtering effects and dynamics, system dynamics, is genital-centric conception of Christianity. That the genital-related issues always seem to take the center stage again and again and again until the whole thing. Like Alan Watts said, that you can really tell what the religion is about. He's talking about Christianity, of course. He said that you can tell what the religion is about by identifying what will they kick you out of the church entirely for right away. And he was using an example of sex or relationship. I don't remember if it was adultery. But basically, sexual misbehavior, like you can get away with murder and this and that and the other, cheating, lying, stealing, all these horrible sins, and everyone will weep for you at church and then, you know, invite you to rededicate yourself and so on. But then when you get involved in these sex-related taboos for the church, then they just kick you out. At least that's what he was saying back when he wrote the book. So thus, in any scandals along these lines, I think, really help the ego death theory by pointing out the silliness and hypocrisy of this genital-centric conception of Christianity. Is that really what it's about? Well, clearly, no. The New Testament clearly does not indicate an interest and focus on genital-centric Christianity. I mean, it's not a particular focus there, unlike in pop American Christianity, in evangel, which I don't, lately, I deny the benefit of calling it even Christianity. It's pop American evangelicalism. I don't really recognize it. Well, Christianity has always been, I guess I should focus in by contrasting New Testament Christianity versus pop American evangelicalism. And that's where I would say that if Christianity means New Testament Christianity as understood in the Roman Empire, what passes for Christianity today is not New Testament Christianity. It's, in fact, I mean, so you could debate whether or not it could be called Christianity even. Certainly it's evangelicalism. So I wouldn't so much deny it the label of Christianity, but I would emphasize by using the label of evangelicalism. Over here you have New Testament Christianity. Over there you have evangelicalism, pop American evangelicalism. Two very different religions, two very different, at least they are two completely different versions of the same religion, what could be considered the same religion, but in two totally, completely different versions, as different as, say, the gospel stories versus the Pauline Gnostic-style Christianity, spiritual, experiential Gnostic Christianity is reflected in the writings attributed to Paul, versus the stories of Jesus and his Jewish background. So imagine how different those two components of the New Testament are. Well, then that's comparable to how different New Testament Christianity as a whole is compared to today's pop American evangelicalism. So we need to not mistake, it's very crucial that we not mistake today's religion of evangelicalism for the religion of New Testament Christianity. You can be thoroughly living within the religion of pop American evangelicalism and be basically totally ignorant of New Testament Christianity. Evangelicalism utilizes the New Testament, but not in a way that's true to the New Testament. Instead of following the New Testament, this evangelicalism selectively draws from the New Testament and bends and distorts it, such as to use it to prop up this religion of evangelicalism, rather than truly creating a religion that's led by the New Testament. The New Testament, it claims to be, you know, the claim of being led by the New Testament is just a claim. People, groups, and denominations can fall into doing diametrically the opposite. Thus, it's important to keep in mind Jesus saying of there are many who say my name, but few who are actual followers. The claim to be a follower of Jesus, the claim that one's denomination, the claim of a denomination that it follows Jesus is just a claim, and it has to be judged. The denomination still has yet to be judged as far as whether it does in fact follow Jesus or whether it merely claims to and utters his name, but is merely utilizing the figure of Jesus towards their own distinct ends that were not drawn forth or pushed out, that were not drawn forth from the New Testament, but were rather rooted in the culture of rather new and transient culture of pop American evangelicalism. That's one thing I really emphasize about evangelicalism is it's a new religion. It's recent, like 1950, and it deserves to pass as quickly as it arrived. Not that I have anything horribly against the religion, this new invented religion, this non-New Testament religion of evangelicalism, but you know, many people have written a lot of complaints about this religion of evangelicalism. It's not, my complaint, of course, would be that it does not offer you a true Eucharist and it does not cause actual mental regeneration and transformation. So it's not even a religion. I mean, from my point of view, according to the standards laid out in the ego death theory and paradigm, evangelicalism is not even, in fact, a religion. It's a lower order religion at best, which really fails the definition of a bona fide religion. It's more of a conduct of life system that's labeled as a religion. But don't mistake conduct of life lifestyle for a religion. Religion is about, first of all, the dissociative state and how it causes a mental transformation of the mental world model regarding self and time and control across time. The take-up rate, the societal take-up rate of the ego-death theory needs to be analyzed in terms of systems theory, cybernetics effects, filtering effects, positive and negative feedback loops, homeostatic state shift, steady state stabilization, and conflicting goals, as well as goal-seeking, defining and seeking goals and corrections towards those goals. For example, ego-death theory could be considered a correction of modern-era hypotheses and attempts to theorize about the nature of mythology. Ego-death as a theory presents the simpler, much simpler riddle solution. That's one thing. I don't think I've focused and pointed that out enough, but I have used the derogatory term sky castles. Here, on one hand, you have my simple, straightforward riddle solution in 27 pages. And over here in the other ring, you have these 1,000-page tomes that just go on and on that do not provide riddle solutions. Well, they provide theories and scholarly coverage or covering over of topics, but their very bloatedness suggests that these theories are just sky castles that are a lot of hot air in the dark. I've described the modern theories as not really being theories in the plural, but basically just different flavors of the same old, worn-out, modern-era uber theory of myth and religion as alien psychology. These are struggles, you know, highly elaborated struggles to try to understand alien psychology of how these primitives in antiquity were so impressed by ritual that they thought they were having these religious insights and experiences. That's the spirit in which modern era theorizing about religion was done. Meanwhile, here you have me who says, no, it's all metaphor. Here's the simple riddle solution. Boom, there it is, done. So for me, it's almost going above and beyond the need. Publishing a book, a whole 500-page book about laying out the ego-death theory is almost a self-defeating overkill, because it's a riddle solution. You don't need a whole book to be written to explain what the riddle answer is. The 27-page article really amounts to a book in itself. It amounts to a really thick book in terms of its profundity of implication. I do need to perhaps emphasize more that the 27-page article does not spell out each interpretation of each myth. Only recently did I more break out to say, this myth means X, and this mytheme means Y and Z. I felt that I didn't need to in an earlier draft, because the idea is that the paradigm tantamount to a detailed long list of explanation of all the different myths. There's really no point and no need to spell out each individual myth and its meaning, because they're all variations of the same riddle pattern. and riddle answer pattern. Someone might say, the theory is not actually comprehensive because it does not explain this particular myth and how it represents determinism and personal control. But I would say, nonsense. It does explain that. It's not necessary and appropriate to spell out explicitly each individual myth. It's the point of the article is to demonstrate the riddle solution using selected examples. It's comprehensive in that sense. It provides the generalized solution as opposed to providing the math answer to every possible math question. Newton's book explains, here's the framework and here are some examples to show that the framework works, but you can apply this framework to an infinite number of other particular specific cases. I don't want to encourage prophecy-oriented thinking or that style of thinking. It's just an amusing coincidence, I think, a noteworthy amusing coincidence that these ideas of the Kali Yugas or different ages, and people say that now I'm rediscovering. I mean, I've read about these kinds of ideas since Wilbur's rather forced at times, I think, his treatment of societal evolution. Wilbur is very much an evolutionist, talking about psychospiritual development, and at a societal level, he thought of that in his early books as psychospiritual evolution of the whole culture. Really, I think that the only thing that you can prophecy, really, is more in the sense of the Old Testament prophecies of this terrible thing is going to happen unless you do X and pray to God. So in that sense, I can prophecy that the only legitimate prophecy I can make is that if you think about thus and such and enter the dissociative state, you will experience ego death and be forced to do this and that. I can prophecy about in that manner. But as far as saying, well, there's these four ages of humanity as predicted in this ancient book, that's rubbish. I would rather emphasize that that's just magical thinking rather than encouraging anyone and misleading anyone to thinking that that's the style in which the ego death theory was developed. Similarly, in the New Testament context, the prophecies in the New Testament are often just polemical modifications of the Roman imperial kinds of prophecies or claims of a new era having arrived. These prophecies of everything being swept away and set renewed is mystic metaphors combined with or put in the form of polemical rebuttal and a counter to the existing claims of new era having arrived under Caesar.